headlines say X,
he's got the Y.
It's the Rob Snow Show on Rogers TV and City News.
101.1 FM and 1310 AM.
Was it premature to swap out the snow tires? I guess for better or worse, we'll find out tomorrow. Good morning. Welcome to the Rob Snow Show on City News. Big show, big show, big show ahead. Happy 420. If you happen to partake, pothead day. I wonder if anybody has actually ever measured Canada's workplace productivity on this day. And, you know, is there a noticeable difference? You know, StatsCan has an entire cannabis statistical hub. And I happened to be browsing through it this morning. For example, since the start of the pandemic, a little more than a year ago, sales of non-medical licensed marijuana, so legal marijuana for recreational purposes, it's only gone in one direction, those sales, up like an Elon Musk rocket ship. Since the start of the pandemic, January to the end of March 2020, sales of non-medical licensed marijuana, $539 million. But by the fourth quarter of 2020, which is the last quarter StatsCan has on record, sales hit $918 million. In other words, over the course of the pandemic year, pot sales, legal pot sales for recreational purposes, increased 70%. Now, maybe that's because there, you know, there was a lot of people had a lot of time on their hands, a lot of younger people with a lot of money they otherwise would not have. It's SER by another name, Cannabis Emergency Response Benefit. You like that, eh? Okay. Yeah, I thought that was kind of clever, too. Despite those sales numbers, when Canadians were asked in a Statistics Canada survey, are you smoking more weed because of the pandemic and because of lockdowns, roughly 9 out of 10 Canadians surveyed said no, they weren't. The age group, however, most likely to say, yeah, I'm smoking more weed, 15 years old to 34 years old. That age group also more likely to say, yeah, I'm drinking more alcohol, too. And across the board, Canadians were more likely to say they were drinking more alcohol than they were smoking more weed. Neither. Good for the mental health, of course. Well-established. And StatsCan notes that Canadians who are reporting worsening mental health conditions are also more likely to say they've been drinking more booze and smoking more pot. All told, after all of these years of legalization of marijuana in Canada, this is more or less where things stand right now, okay, according to StatsCan. We have a little bit more than 700,000 Canadians smoking pot every day, but 718,000 Canadians smoke it every day. About 1.3 million Canadians smoke pot at least once a week, and about 5 million Canadians have smoked pot at least once in the last 3 months. The average price Canada-wide for a gram of marijuana is $8.18. Smoke them if you got them. Happy Cannabis Day. We're going to have an executive on the show this morning from the cannabis industry. The next frontier in legal pot could be the American market. The Democrats are running the show, and a lot of people are expecting more liberalized pot laws at the federal level, which could create a whole new green gold rush. Big story. I would also like to offer felicitacion, congratulations to SNC-Lavalin. Out of the bad books of the World Bank. For those of you who may not be aware, Justin Trudeau's favorite company, SNC-Lavalin, was blacklisted by the World Bank after the company was caught bribing officials in Bangladesh. And during that World Bank investigation, lo and behold, the World Bank learned that SNC-Lavalin had also been bribing officials in Cambodia. So the company was banned from bidding on any contract financed by the World Bank, banned, blacklisted for 10 years. But today, the company, in a statement, has proudly announced it has received a get-out-of-jail-free card. Granted early release. That banishment was supposed to last until 2023. It's now been lifted entirely. And SNC promises it will never, 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 never have envelopes stuffed with cash ever again. Okay. It has created a chief integrity officer now. As a chief integrity officer. Memories of lab scam. Jobs, jobs, jobs. It was all about the jobs and the 9,000 jobs. And it's the prime minister's job to stand up for jobs, especially jobs in Quebec, because he's the MP for Papineau, don't you know? Good times. Good times. Speaking of jobs, you know, creating jobs, saving jobs, plenty of reaction to the big spending, big promising federal budget on the program this morning. The budget delivered yesterday by the Trudeau government. 2 years in the planning, 2 years in the making, and the best the Liberals can get from Paul Wells from Maclean's magazine this morning is that this budget is middling. It's middling. It's not bad. It's not great. It's really long. It's more than 700 pages long, this budget. And at the end of it, it's middling. It is a middling budget. Others really aren't that charitable. In the Globe and Mail, Andrew Coyne wonders this morning just how the Trudeau Liberals plan to pay for everything, all the profligate spending. Because a bill actually does eventually come due. There is no free lunch. John Iveson over at the National Post suggested it's a budget designed for the times, especially if it's election time, because the Conservatives will be seen as, well, as Liberals usually see them, the Conservatives will be seen as heartless and cruel and tight-fisted and austere, only in it for the moneyed elite. All the while, the Liberals will cut the NDP off at the pass because it is a budget filled with policies and promises, many of them plucked right from Tom Mulcair's election campaign of 2015. The issue really is, for me, and I am in the minority, and believe me, I understand it all as I look at these eye-popping numbers, budget deficits of $345 billion, and chicken in every pot. I wonder how we're going to pay for it all, especially because interest rates are on the rise. But you say, Rob, interest rates are on the rise, but mortgage rates are at rock bottom, and the Bank of Canada's not been raising interest rates. Hey, don't kid yourselves. Look at the bond market. You can look it up every morning for yourself, like I did this morning. Long-term interest rates on Government of Canada bonds have been moving up. That's the money we borrow from Wall Street, from lenders all over the world. They're demanding a higher interest rate from Canada now. Much higher interest rates than this time last year. Much, much higher interest rates than they were in January. Above 2% now on a 30-year bond, 1.6% on a 10-year bond. 10-year bond yields up 100 basis points in just the last 4 months. Imagine the front page news stories if the Bank of Canada raised interest rates by 100 basis points. It'd be all over the news, all anybody was talking about. You know why? Because it's a big news story. But the Trudeau Liberals, they have decided nobody right now needs to feel any pain. And you really can have it all, because you're not going to pay for it. Our kids are going to pay for it, and their kids will pay for it. On down the line, they're going to foot the bill. And there's not going to be any new taxes today. Well, okay, a few new taxes. They're going to hike the taxes on smokes, and there's going to be a new tax on yachts and a new tax on fancy cars. But let's face it, you shouldn't smoke anyway. And who doesn't want to stick it to the rich with their fancy boats and their fancy cars? We'll get into all of it. The federal budget, the child care promise, $10 a day if the provinces buy in. National child care from Liberals, no less. Stop me if you've heard this one before. Maybe they actually mean it this time. Professor Ian Lee will be here from the Sprott School of Business at Carleton University. Always a lot to say about any federal budget. Dan Kelly from the CFIB on the continuing and brand new support programs in the budget for the battered, beaten, and bruised business sector. And I think we should continue our conversation about the leadership of Ontario Premier Doug Ford. Now, 3 weeks ago, it's like a different world politically for Premier Ford. I mean, 3 weeks ago, there was a poll that said Doug Ford would win another election in a landslide. Even a majority of Liberals thought the Premier was doing a good job handling the pandemic. Now, there's another poll, and it's a different time, and his approval numbers are back in the tank. And according to news reports, there are, quote, growing calls for his resignation. Are you one of them? Do you think Doug Ford should resign because of the position, the state of affairs in Ontario right now with COVID-19? We can get into that during the talk back hour. We do that every morning between 10 and 11 o'clock around here. Call-in radio, hottest hour of talk radio in town, 750-1310 is our call-in line. The Rob Snow Show at ottawa.citynews.ca's email address. You got to love it. You got to love it. Justin Trudeau fails to deliver vaccine. He breaks the ethics laws three times. He can't tell us how many times he's worn blackface. He just delivered a budget with a $350 billion budget deficit and promises nothing but decades of red ink to come. And yet, if the election was today, it's Justin in a landslide, but Doug Ford should resign. That's why they say, you know, if you want a friend in politics, get a dog. This is the Rob Snow Show on City News.
The world is changing.
So keep up with Rob.
The Rob Snow Show returns on Rogers TV and City News. 101.1 FM and 1310 AM.
Well, the day after the federal budget, the centerpiece, child care. Federal government promises to invest roughly $30 billion over 5 years in early learning and child care services, off promises never fully delivered by the federal Liberals. Let's get into it with Peter John Mitchell. Joins me this morning. He is with the think tank where he's a family program director at CARTIS. Good morning.
Good morning, Rob.
Yeah, nice to hear from you, sir. Thank you for taking the time this morning. What do you think, based on what you know about the policy, the promise delivered yesterday by the Trudeau government on child care?
I'm a little bit disappointed. I think it was an opportunity that was missed. The National Plan for Early Learning and Child Care, I think, is structurally opposed to equity for all families. And I say that, Rob, because it limits funding based to the type of care that families use. So we know from Statistics Canada data that families use diverse forms of care. Some of that is within the licensed system in daycare centers or in licensed home cares, and some of that happens outside of the licensed system in unregulated home care or with a relative or having somebody come into the home to provide care. But the plan really focuses that $30 billion on those who are using licensed care. And the plan to expand child care spaces really focuses on the nonprofit sector of licensed care. So some families will benefit from lower costs, but many families will not.
In advance of the budget, a lot was made of the Trudeau government's fondness for modeling any national program on the Quebec model, which when launched was $7 a day, operates on a sliding scale now. What do you think about using, say, the Quebec model as a national model for a child care system?
Yes, so I think the draw to the Quebec model is that it offers care at low user prices, and that's what's attractive about it. But almost right out of the gate, it's really struggled to provide high-quality care. The program was intended to provide a network of center-based care, CPEs, which were going to be the high-quality part of the program, but only about a third of children are in those high-quality spaces. And looking at the Quebec Auditor General's report from last fall, about 46,000 children in Quebec are still waiting to get into those spaces. Another 9,000 are in non-subsidized care. So it's something that that is a system that has grown exponentially in terms of cost, and it really in 20 years hasn't really delivered the type of high-quality care that it was really intended to. And so I think that serves as a cautionary tale. I think, Rob, that there's actually potential for provinces to trip over the starting line right at the start of this five-year commitment and then spend the rest of the time really trying to catch up. The centerpiece of the program is really to lower the cost of licensed care. The eventual plan is really to get to a $10 a day system, but they're going to start with cutting costs in licensed care by about 50%. So when you obviously when you cut prices, like when you put a product on sale, you incentivize its use, and that's really part of the plan. It's really to try to attract those who are not currently parents, that are not currently in the paid labor force, to come into the force. So that will probably and most likely push up demand, but it also for those who are already in the workforce but perhaps using forms of care that won't be subsidized, when you offer care at 50%, they're going to be looking to see whether that's going to be a good move for them. So you can imagine that somebody who's using the neighborhood neighbor down the street who is offering care out of her home, maybe she's caring for her own children and also caring for other children. If she is not licensed, she's not receiving any benefit from the cost of cutting the cost there. So it really incentivizes parents to then switch over to forms of care that are subsidized. So for that provider, they're going to have to make a choice about whether they're going to be able to stay open or they try to move into the licensed system. But I think it's going to create significant demand, or potentially, and perhaps provinces are not going to be prepared to be able to meet that demand.
Right, right.
With that. And then,
well,
and
you know, Mr. Mitchell, I mean, it all hinges on it being a 50-50 cost-sharing arrangement, which is a pretty large caveat. I do wonder, and I'd like your opinion, how open you think provinces are right now, just given the fiscal position of the provinces, to going 50-50 on childcare.
Yeah, I mean, the national plan really asks the provinces to carry the bulk of the work. They're the ones that license care, regulate care, legislate on care, and provide most of the funding for care. So it's really up to the provinces to be able to implement this national plan, this Made in Ottawa plan, and it is they will carry the burden of some of that financial risk and certainly the political risk if things don't go well. And it depends on province to province. Care looks very different from province to province. In a place like Alberta, you have a higher use of for-profit care in their sector that they depend on. Mm-hmm. In other places, less so. So it certainly will dangle money over the provinces' sort of heads and ask them to participate. And I'm certain there will be stringent strings attached to the money that's delivered to provinces.
Such as
it could be, and how that money is spent or where it's spent. There could be targets for how many spaces need to be created. Possibly, we don't really know from the release yesterday. It doesn't give us a lot of details, but certainly the federal government has some objectives that it's going to want to meet, and it's going to really need provinces to achieve those for them. And so I'm sure that there will be restrictions on how that money is spent.
Okay. How do you view child care? Do you view it as a social policy, or do you view it as an economic policy? It was put to me in the last week. We have to stop thinking of it in terms of a big social program. Think of it as something that can further economic growth in Canada. First of all, just let me finish for a second. It will provide relief to households because childcare is very expensive, especially in the big city. And it gets women into the workforce, earning money, paying taxes, being economically more productive in the economy. So you should view it as a good economic policy. How do you view it?
Well, I view childcare as the care of a child, no matter who provides that care, and that's valuable. And if that's happening in a paid setting, that's childcare. If it's happening in an unpaid setting or even by a parent, that's valuable. And all care work, whether it's paid or unpaid, is valuable. Certainly the release yesterday was framed mostly in the idea that this is an economic policy and that the purpose of childcare is to boost GDP, get more parents working more hours for the economy. I would prefer to put the well-being of child and children ahead of the economy when it comes to childcare, because it affects children. And I think the parents are in the best position to make those decisions. So I would far rather see money directed towards parents who could then choose the type of care that is best for their children. I think that's that was a missed opportunity in yesterday's budget. I certainly think that the federal government has existing levers that they could have pulled to lower the cost for childcare is very expensive, and it can be very expensive. But there are other levers that they could have pulled. They could have made adjustments to the childcare expense deduction. They could have made that refundable and helped lower income families. They could have looked at the Canada Child Benefit and making continue to make changes there or enhance that benefit that helps put money in the parents' pockets. Okay.
Peter John Mitchell from CARTAS, thank you for your time this morning.
Thanks so much for having me on, Rob.
Yep. Professor Ian Lee from the Sprott School of Business at Carleton University, right after the news on City News.
Firm.
Fair.
Fun.
The Rob Snow Show returns
on Rogers TV and City News, 101.1 FM
and 1310 AM.
He's the poor professor from the Glee, Professor Ian Lee, Sprott School of Business, Carleton University. Good morning. Welcome back.
Good morning, Rob.
What did you think of the budget?
Well, I was in the virtual lockup, and so I had the documents from 9 a.m. yesterday morning. And I give you my word, I read every page, every line, almost every line. There were some sections I skimmed over because they weren't as salient to what I wanted to focus on. Okay. I focused like a laser beam on the macroeconomic outlook and the overall spending. But there's three big takeaways that I don't think anyone else is talking about. So let me just throw them out there.
Sure,
okay?
Thing. Love it. Love it.
Three very big, sort of meta, macro big, okay? The first is that Chrystia Freeland spent an excellent job in the first 30 pages documenting with superb graphs. I urge people to go look at it, showing over and over and over how the economy is just doing gangbusters, just exploding. In fact, she said it grew 10% in the last quarter. I mean, that makes the Chinese envious. The Chinese, they have the fastest growing economy of any major economy in the world. They grow year after year at 6%. Unheard of for the rest of us that are going along at a miserable 1.5% to 2% pre-COVID. We went at 10%. So that's great. And we've covered almost all the jobs, and she went through all the metrics. And she said, give her credit, that the government underestimated the resilience and recovery of the economy last spring, last fall, and again this winter, this spring. And so she showed all that. Then she pivoted and then started talking about, we've got to get out of this COVID recession. Now, listen, if we're growing at 10% or 6% forecast after inflation is removed for 2021, that is not a recession. Under no stretch of the imagination can anybody say that that's a recession. Okay. So she's came up with a solution, the budget, of massive spending for a problem that does not exist. We are not in a recession. The economy fell off the cliff last March, full acknowledgement of that. But nobody can argue when you're growing at 10% or 6%. With inflation removed, that you're in a recession.
Well, I mean, even if you grow at 5% annualized, a gangbuster year. I mean, a historic year.
It's not a recession. Yeah. The second point was, and very big picture, and then I'll get the third one, and then we can talk about all these. But the second point is, I mean, everyone's talking nonstop for the last year about COVID.
Yes.
And long-term care homes and the crisis. And everyone's talking about shortages of ICU and shortages of nurses and shortages of doctors and shortages of vaccines. Yep. It's a healthcare crisis.
Yes.
So you would think out of all the things that we could spend money on in this country, there must be tons of money going into public healthcare, right? No. They announced on spending just about on everything you can imagine except healthcare. Now, I just find that astonishing and gobsmacking. The third one, Right. And I haven't heard any pundit talk about this yet.
All right.
I suggest that people go to the appendix. That's where the truth is, by the way, in any federal budget. It's not the verbiage and the bloviating in all the words and the sentences and the paragraphs in chapters 1 to 6 in any budget by any finance minister of any party. No. Go to the numbers in the appendix. That's where there's truth to power. That's where they have the real numbers, not the bloviation. And so I went to the revenues, and they are astonishing.
Yeah.
They, believe me, they are astonishing. I urge everybody to go there. The revenues today compared to the revenues from 4 years from now are four. Now, this is gross annual revenues. This is personal income tax, HST, you name it.
Yeah.
All sources of revenues.
For the federal government. For the federal government.
Government of Canada.
Yeah.
Are forecast to go up by, in 4 years, by about one third.
Wow.
Now, that's over 4 years.
Right.
Now, the average Canadian is making 1% to 2% increase a year on their wages. Let's go generous and give everybody a 2% increase.
Huh.
2% over a year times 4 years is an 8% increase. The total tax take over the next 4 years of the government is going to go up by a third. Our wages are not going up by a third. Now, people say, oh, well, that's okay because corporate income taxes are going up, which they are, but that's so are personal income taxes, by the way, and so are all other HST taxes. But my point is, ultimately, all taxes come out of the economy. And that is to say, we are indirectly paying. I mean, corporate taxes are paid on, passed on by corporations to us through lower wages or higher price of goods. That's been documented by studies for literally the last 50 years. No serious person who understands economics suggests otherwise. So my point is, because the economy is finite, there's a finite amount of us, there's a finite amount of GDP at any moment in time, those taxes ultimately are being paid by us. And so the dark and dirty secret that nobody's talking about is that it's really astonishing. And I urge people to go there to A15 and look at these tax increases. And by the way, they're all going up. It's not that I'm saying one tax.
Well, they tax increases or anticipated revenue from the taxes collected.
Everything. Corporate income taxes are going up by actually not a huge amount, but personal income taxes are going up, HST is going up, Crown Corporation revenues are going up. People have said it's a good thing. But all I'm pointing out...
But going up because of economic activity, you mean?
Oh, well, sure. Right. I have no problem with that.
But it's not like the GST is not going from 5% to 6%.
No, I wasn't suggesting that they were putting... They're
not raising taxes. They're getting growth.
What used to be called bracket creep.
Right.
We'll call it growth creep. I mean... Their tax take is going to go up by about 30 to 32%, okay, in the next 4 years when our wages are not going up 32%. That's all I'm saying.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. Yeah,
like,
I understand. I just wanted to be clear what you're saying. That's all.
And I urge people to go and download the document is free, and it's in the annexes. It's in Annex 1. And it's A15, and it's really an eye-opener, I tell you. And it breaks it down so you can see year by year for the next 4 years each one of the taxes, the revenue streams going up, and they're all going up. And they're all going up very substantially. It's really, really, really fascinating. I urge everybody to look at that table.
Okay. So where do you want to start as we get a little more into the minutiae of this?
Well,
why don't we start with number one? I think your big picture theme, your macro theme, is there is no COVID recession. If there is no COVID recession, why do we need $100 billion in stimulus spending? Fair enough?
That's exactly what I'm saying.
Right.
And you know, she said... If you even take her at her word, and I am, I'm not suggesting she was being dishonest. She said, we've got to, you know, grow the economy, you know, kickstart the economy out of the COVID recession.
Yes.
Yet when you look at much, not all, but much of the spending is disguised social spending. Now, I'm not saying that social spending is bad, although we already spend an enormous amount in Canada. But my point is they have reclassified spending, and they've called it often infrastructure. So a lot of the social spending they're now calling social infrastructure.
Yes.
Now,
yes.
You know, people say, well, you're just quibbling. No, I'm not. The infrastructure, why economists have liked it, going all the way back to Adam Smith, and I'm not going to go deep into the weeds, but infrastructure, I'm talking roads, railroads, ports, airports, pipelines, speed up the movement of goods and services, which makes the economy more productive, which facilitates and enhances growth, which leads to more jobs, which leads to more taxes. It's a completely virtuous circle. Social spending, although I'm not saying, well, I understand why we do it, but it's not infrastructure. And so what I'm saying is she kept saying we need to grow the economy, and yet most of the measures she announced are not going to grow the economy. That's my point.
Well, this is a point made by some of the columnists today, like Coyne and Iveson. There's a lot of distribution.
You know,
there's a lot of economic distribution, but not a lot of policy that would promote economic growth.
Yes.
Right? Wealth distribution
is
replacing wealth creation.
Spending,
right? Yeah.
disguised as infrastructure and investment. She kept using the word investment. Andrew Coyne Googled it, I guess, and found that the word investment was used, I can't remember, 1,000 times in the budget document or something. And so...
Yeah, and competitive, the word competitiveness is used like 9 times.
Yeah,
or something
exactly.
Like that. Yeah, yeah.
And so what she's done is this is a massive spending document, but it's not a growth document. That's where I'm going. By the way, I found the table I was trying to talk to you about for those at home. It's page 329 of the PDF document. It's table A1.5, total revenue outlook. Personal income tax in 4 years is going to go from $167 billion to $213 billion. But the total revenues, the total budgetary revenues, are going to go from $334 billion today. Third of a trillion.
Yes.
$34 billion.
Yes. Yeah.
In 4 years, they're going to go to $437 billion.
Wow.
Now that's about a third increase in 4 years when inflation is supposedly at a very low rate of only 2% a year. Now, ceteris paribus, to use the old phrase, the Latin phrase, which means all of the things being equal, the revenue should be growing by roughly, you know, the inflation rate with a little bit of growth thrown in. So, but maybe 4% a year instead of 2%. They're growing much faster than that. That's my point. So there's disguised tax increases in here, such as the digital services
tax,
which is a tax on the middle class. Let's get that out there. They kept saying, we're going to tax these foreign digital giants. No, they're not. They're taxing me because I use Amazon Prime Video and I subscribe to Netflix. That's a tax on you and me. It's not a tax on Netflix. It's not a tax on Amazon. And they're spinning this already. They're going to go and tax the foreigners, you know. No, they're not. They're taxing us.
Right. Okay. But if revenues are going to go up by, say, $100 billion or more, okay, over the next 4 years, then do the liberals have a point? Don't chew my head off, Professor. That we can afford these programs. We can afford to do $30 billion worth of childcare investment. Look, if the revenues are coming in, the money's there.
Here, by the way, I don't want anyone to think I'm against the childcare.
Right.
I think it can be criticized because they made it universal. They did not use the word universal. I actually read the document carefully about 3 or 4 times on this section. They said all parents with children, that's universality.
Yes.
So that means a doctor making $1 million a year is going to get $10 a day daycare. Mm. What? A professor making $250,000 a year, and there are, not me, but there are professors on the Sunshine List making $250,000 a year are going to get $10 a day daycare.
Yep.
What is going through their brain? What on earth? Yes, targeted to low-income people. Yes, targeted to people who need help,
sure,
which roughly is the bottom two quintiles, I would say, probably the bottom 40%.
Yep.
But what on earth are they doing giving a DG in the government of Canada making $130,000 or $150,000 a year subsidized daycare for $10 a day? So that's the criticism I have there. But to your larger point, I'm not getting away from it.
Right.
What we've done is we have run up, we've doubled the debt. It's gone from about 25% of GDP to 50% of GDP in a very short period of time, 3-4 years. And more to the point, we are moving, and people just still haven't glommed onto this. And starting with the Minister of Finance, she's talking about these massive numbers of unemployed people, which isn't massive, number one. The unemployment rate has plummeted since the recovery is underway.
Okay.
But more importantly, for the next 30 to 50 years, we are going to be facing massive labor shortages. I don't say so. The IMF says so. The OECD says so. Finance Canada, in a separate document on aging, said so. Every study I have read has predicting serious, serious shortages, okay, of labor. And so that means that we are going to, our economies are going to shrink, slow down, and Finance Canada has projected that. We're going to be growing much more slowly. And for those out there, and there's progressives who say, who cares about growth? Slower growth means, in plain, blunt, direct English, lower revenues for the government of Canada, lower revenues for the provinces to pay for health care and universities. So they're going to have less money going forward to pay for a much larger debt proportionately.
Right,
indeed,
right.
The interest paid in 3 years from now, 4 years from now, by 2025, is going to double from $20 billion to $40 billion a year. So that's money we're squandering on interest on the debt, because we have to pay it, because we unnecessarily decided in this budget to go out and try to give goodies to every last identifiable interest group in all of Canada.
Okay.
And it was unnecessary because we're not in a COVID recession. We should have targeted like a laser beam on the things we do need to do, daycare for low-income and modest-income families for sure, health care, much more money, which they didn't do for sure, but all of the other, many of the other things they're doing is simply squandering to buy the election, to get reelected.
Okay. We'll stop here. Some final thoughts on the federal budget delivered yesterday. I must have your take on Aaron O'Toole, carbon tax. He says it's not a tax because you're going to get whatever you pay in a carbon tax, you'll get it back into your own personal green savings account, Professor. I have to ask you about that as well.
I want to talk about that.
Rob Snow Show on City News.
He's a pillar of community opinion.
The Rob Snow Show returns
on Rogers TV and City News.
101.1 FM
and 1310 AM.
We don't have a lot of time left with you, Professor Ian Lee. Did you get a shot yet, by the way?
I'm going Wednesday afternoon.
Oh, good for you.
Tomorrow afternoon at 3 o'clock, I finally, after my sister who got her both shots 3 months ago, who's 10 years younger than me in perfect health, and her three children who are in perfect health got their shots, I'm finally getting my shot.
Oh,
they
good.
Live in the States, though,
good.
By the way.
Good, good, good. I'm glad to hear that. I'm glad to hear that. If for no other reason than I don't have to listen to you whine and complain about it. okay. All right.
Well, you know, our healthcare system is superior. I mean, I tell people write me emails all the time telling me how wonderful it is. I said, well, if it's so wonderful, then how come we're doing so badly? Yeah. But nobody wants to talk about that. So
are you not worried? A few more things on the budget. Are you not worried that there's really nothing set aside anymore for a rainy day? This is Don Drummond's point in his column for iPolitics.
You know, I would put it differently, slightly different, but we're really saying the same thing.
Yeah.
We, the government, has dramatically reduced the wiggle room, the degrees of freedom, to use a fancy academic term, for future crises. As he put it, the government is assuming for the next 30 years there will be no recessions, no increase in inflation, no increase in interest rates, because all of that has to pertain for them to meet all of their very rosy forecasts. And, of course, that's preposterous. And there will be recessions, and there will be future crises, whether they're pandemics or, who knows, a horrible earthquake on Vancouver Island or something. You know, I mean, the black swans are unpredictable.
Yeah.
That's the point.
Yeah.
And they have no wiggle room there. We've doubled the debt. The provinces are essentially becoming unsustainable, and that's from the Parliamentary Budget Office, not from me.
Sure, sure, sure. Yeah.
We're going to be bailing out not just Newfoundland and Labrador in 2, 3, 5, or 7 years. lenders will be bailing out. There'll be other provinces that'll enter insolvency where the bond market simply refuse to buy their bonds anymore. And so this budget has set us up for future suffering and pain. The problem is he won't be around. There is a rough justice in this world, and I won't say this with any happiness, believe me, but we boomers have much less time left, to be blunt. Okay, I'm just using the actuarial tables. The millennials, who are, I think it's fair to say, are much more supportive of Mr. Trudeau, are going to be bearing the burden of these policies for much longer because they've got many, many more years of their lives ahead of them. They've got 50, 60 years ahead. We don't. People in their 60s and 70s, just from the actuarial tables, don't have 50, 70 years ahead of us. So the squandering and this budget, which I do believe was irresponsible, is going to, down the road, fall on the shoulders of the people that supported it, which are generally much younger people. And so there is, I guess you could say, there's a very rough justice in the world. It's not very nice, but there is a rough justice.
Okay. Aaron O'Toole says the Conservative Party is going to have a carbon tax. It will be, what was it? Was it $20 to start? $20 a ton to start, maxing out at $50, but it's not really a tax. Professor, don't call it a tax. Because whatever you pay is going to go into a green savings account, and you can buy green things with the solar panels and bicycles and twisty light bulbs and stuff.
First, I applaud him because I think it's inevitable. We're going into a world where there's an increasing consensus, and I realize there's a strong minority that isn't. But, you know, look, that train has left the station.
Yeah.
You know, I'm with Harper on, you know, look, the abortion has been decided.
Yeah.
Let's stop talking about it. Gay rights are the law of the land, and I support that.
Sure.
Let's not try and imagine going back to a past where it's not going to be the case.
Okay.
The carbon tax is going to be adopted, has been adopted in many countries, and it's just a reality we must confront. Then we should be saying, okay, which carbon tax? What's the optimal carbon tax? And I think that this is a better carbon tax, and I'm calling it a carbon tax because it is. OECD defines a tax as a compulsory payment by government imposed by the government on the people of the country. This is a tax. But I think it's a better tax than the liberal tax. I just want to quickly say that I was truly astonished at the, and I'm going to be very blunt, and I'm sorry if it sounds rude, but at the ignorance of the Minister of the Environment, who clearly doesn't understand his own carbon tax. Let me explain that.
Okay, we only have a minute. We only have a minute, so hurry up.
He said, this is going to encourage people, the carbon tax of the Conservatives, to go out and pollute more, use more fossil fuels. I said, this is the most ridiculous idea that I'm going to go out and drive around the block 50 times to get back a rebate, which is about 5% of the cost of the fuel.
Yeah.
That's how little the environment minister understands about the tax.
Okay.
Both tax fossil fuels. The more fossil fuels you consume, the more tax you'll pay under both the Liberal and the Conservatives. The Liberal tax is higher, for sure, so actually you could flip him on his head and say the Liberal tax encourages people to consume fossil fuels more than the Conservatives because the tax is higher. And so what Aaron O'Toole is doing is setting up these accounts. I think it's going to be difficult and not easy from the execution point of view, but at least he's saying we're not going to use it as a disguised income redistribution, which is what Mr. Trudeau's doing, because he's promised low-income people will get back far more than they paid in. That's just disguised income redistribution. So at least Aaron O'Toole is an honest carbon tax, and he's saying, okay, it'll go into an account, and you can only access that money if you spend it on green initiatives that will reduce your carbon footprint. So I applaud that.
Okay. Great stuff this week. Thank you, Professor. Always a pleasure.
Thanks very much.
Yep. Ian Lee, Professor of Management, Sprott School of Business, here with us every week, every Tuesday morning on the Rob Snow Show on City News.